The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. You're very welcome. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, or walking past somewhere where this is being played. We appreciate all forms of engagement. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science for instant reaction. And we get to all that stuff later on in the podcast. Coming up on this week's programme, tomorrow, the Solar Orbiter will launch. This is a huge and very cool mission for the European Space Agency in which we'll fling around, I think it's Venus, and then we fling around the Earth, and then we go towards, not quite the centre of the sun, but we ping ourselves towards it, to have a look at the poles, to see what's going on at the poles. And so we're going to be speaking to, I suppose, Ireland's premier solar scientist. I'm sure you won't mind us calling that, Professor Peter Gallagher. And he's going to be talking about why we're looking at the sun and why it's interesting to think about what's going on at the poles. Because if you think about it, when we look outside our window, don't actually do this, and look at the sun, we only ever see the sides. We never see the top and the bottom. Who knows what could be there? We'll find out as a result of this expedition. And we'll be speaking to Peter in a few minutes' time. But first, it's time to look back at the week's news and science stories. And joining me in studio is Dr. Laura Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
I was diagnosed about 7 years ago. My life expectancy is normal. My particular course of MS is called relapsing remitting. Fever and stress tend to be two things that'll induce an attack.
Well, you're president of the United States. You're delivering the State of the Union address tomorrow night, and you have 102 degree fever. So I guess we're out of the woods.
Has to do with MS. That's Martin Sheen from The West Wing there. Slightly misrepresenting the disease, I think, quite badly if you see the whole clip. This is about research in Trinity to do with MS. It's quite exciting.
I think this is really exciting. I'm completely biased. I have to admit now, this is my old group where I did my PhD and my postdoc. And I think they're brilliant. So I'm going to obviously want to cover this story. But it is really interesting. And I also love that it's Irish research. We are one of the best countries in the world. I think we're the third best in terms of immunological publications in the entire world, if you take us per capita. So Ireland is brilliant at this. And this is from Kingston Mills Lab. It's from Dr. Aoife McGinley. And what she's looked at is the mouse model for MS. They don't look at the human cells themselves, but it's a very good representation. It's called EAE. And what they found is there's a cytokine, which is a type of chemical that's found in the body, and it's called IL-17. And at the moment, it's already being used to treat humans with rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis. And it's been almost classed as the wonder drug for psoriasis. People who have this horrendous psoriasis for years and years almost completely cures it. But it started in trials for MS. And one of the most fascinating things about drugs is that it's not just the drug that's important. It's when you give it and where you give it. So you could be using the perfect drug, but you'd be giving it at the wrong time into the wrong system in the body, and it won't do anything. And this new paper from Kingston's lab has shown that this IL-17, which they always thought was really important further down the line in the MS when it's all up in the brain, they think is actually activating cells out in the periphery and doing jobs, bad jobs, causing the disease much earlier back out in the lymph nodes. So it's really important because it could help target therapies for this disease, which in Ireland alone affects about 9,000 people. Which is the same number of people that die from cancer every year. So it is a really important disease. Now, people from MS actually tend not to die as a result of the disease, and they tend not to lose any life expectancy. So that's one thing Jed Bartlett did say, right? A lot of his things weren't quite perfect there. But I just think it's brilliant research, and I love that it's Irish research as well. Now, if you do Google the paper, my name does come up 5 times, no big deal, but I'm not in the paper. I didn't write it. I'm just referenced. So I swear I'm not being paid for this.
So this is something that I hadn't really considered, that over the past number of decades, I mean, bringing a drug from molecule to medicine is so tricky, as we know. It costs so much money, as the pharmaceutical companies tell us all the time when they try and justify the amount of money that they spend and the cost of those drugs. But it is a really tricky thing to do. And actually, the timing and the placing of these drugs is not something I thought about. Is it more difficult to administer in the lymph nodes than somewhere else?
No, one of the interesting things about MS is that it's in the brain and spinal cord, which means that the cells have to cross a thing called the blood-brain barrier, which is very hard to cross. So if you are treating a disease earlier, back out in the lymph nodes, then you need a medication that doesn't have to cross the blood-brain barrier, which actually, in theory, is way better because it has potential for less side effects, has potential for easier administration. So actually, this could be really interesting in terms of getting a medication that doesn't have to cross the blood-brain barrier. And also, when you administer it. So it actually, IL-17 has been shown to make certain diseases like Crohn's disease worse, which is really counterintuitive. But maybe it's that they were giving it at the wrong time in the disease. You know, so it could be a brilliant drug at the wrong time.
So are they all autoimmune diseases?
Yeah, so I once said this at a conference and a guy shouted me down and said it isn't. But yes, MS is an autoimmune disease. Same as rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, Crohn's disease. Your own immune system attacks its cells. So you need to dampen down the immune system. And one of the molecules that does it is IL-17.
I thought IL-17 was where, like, you know, the baby food was kept in Tesco.
I was just thinking that myself. We got a spill in IL-17. Shane, our second story is a really positive story from conservation, which you never really hear, but it has to do with a particular type of tortoise called Lonesome George.
Yeah, do you remember Lonesome George?
Yep.
Yeah,
so he died, unfortunately.
What's the delivery? It's the way he does it.
Yeah, so he died, but he was 102, they estimate, when he died, which is pretty good innings, as they say. The only
Kirk
acceptable
Douglas
use of the term innings,
no,
right? Yes, Kirk Douglas, exactly the same. So recently, a group of conservationists.
No relation.
Of no relation to either Lonesome George or Kirk Douglas were working in the Galapagos, and they were on the largest volcano there, and they discovered 30 giant tortoises that have similar genes to Lonesome George. And one of them, a female, is known to be a direct descendant of Lonesome George. What's unusual about these this group, I don't know the collective noun for tortoises, people should text that in, is that it's crossbreeding between two species. And so this is interesting. They're wondering, firstly, how did that happen? And the best estimate is that pirates and whalers, which used to collect tortoises for food, had them on their ships. They probably got bounty and they had to dump the tortoises somewhere and they put them on this volcano. And since then, they've interbred and they have their own little subspecies.
Which sounds like a sci-fi film, doesn't it?
Yeah, what could go wrong?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
So it's interesting because it's like, well, what can you do with this group of 30? Are they viable? Is this going to last? So that led me down a rabbit hole on the scientific Google to look at and see what is the minimal viable population for a species. And just like any good science story, it's unclear. So yeah,
great.
So that's it. No, there is a general rule called the 50-500 rule, which says that you need a minimum of 50 of a species to have to not have direct inbreeding, and then 500 to have minimize something called genetic drift, which is, you know, too close a relationship but not direct inbreeding. However, there are more recent publications that say for things like a tortoise, which will live very long, potentially can have an awful lot of offspring, perhaps the viable number is lower than 50.
And so they're not quite sure.
Yeah,
whether or
I suppose
not.
We have to wait and see. What I think is cool about this is that how do they find 30 giant tortoises and say this is a discovery? Surely, like, they're huge, right? Maybe it's the genes that they were looking at, and they discovered that they had things in common. There used to be 15 species of tortoise across the Galapagos Islands. The Galapagos Islands, famous for Darwin's discovery of, not discovery, but his
invention,
yeah, of the theory of of evolution. I do that in inverted commas. And so four of them are extinct. So I suppose it's great that we can do work now. We can think about how we might preserve what's left.
Our third story, Lara, has to do with cancer detection. And like all great headlines, it sounds very exciting. But what have we actually found out?
I actually think it is really exciting. It's one of the things I think is so exciting is that it's a real proof of science not acknowledging country boundaries. There's 37 different institutions involved in this huge, massive research study for decades. But what they've found is that they looked at 38 different types of cancer, 2,600 different full genome sequences. So it's absolutely massive.
And wow, that is big.
It's absolutely massive. Like, and it's just, it's brilliant research. It's published in Nature. And what they did was they saw that a lot of the genetic mutations that cause cancer can actually come about years and even decades before the person starts to suffer from cancer. Now, it's not quite as absolutely amazing as it sounds. You know, we're not going to go out and just test every single person when they hit 18 and see if 20 years' time they're going to have a cancer. But One of the...
Not now.
Not now, but I mean, potentially, absolutely.
And if we're talking about SNP sites...
Yeah, exactly. And those are really simple. So SNP sites where there's just one mutation in a single base pair in your DNA sequence. So they're really easy to look at, actually, and really cheap these days. And one of the big things with cancer is it's sort of considered to be a two-hit system. We have two chromosomes of every chromosome in our body, except for the XY. Well, in a man. And if you get a mutation in one, then you get a mutation in the other one down the line, you're more likely, it has to be in a cancer-causing gene, obviously, or one that stops cancer. But what's really interesting is if you do this and if you look at people, you can see people who have this one hit, and that person's obviously far more likely down the road to get the second hit. Now, we have really good surveillance for a lot of cancers like colorectal and breast, but ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, people just die from these. And cancer has now overtaken heart disease as the leading cause of death in Ireland. And if you can find a cheap, easy way to test people without kind of worrying them, because it's actually very good. The results of these DNA tests are very reliable. It would just be phenomenal. And I really think this is going to be what it will be in 10, 20 years time.
Well, I mean, it costs €100 to get a SNP type of test. So this is the 23andMe or Ancestry.com, those sort of not full genome DNA tests, but a specific site test. You know, if people could elect to do those, and I know obviously ideally you'd want to have the same level of healthcare for all, but if you take, you know, the people who are willing to pay that €100 at 18 years old to have that information, you know, that could be really powerful. And take those people, not necessarily out of the beds 30 years later, but, you know, possibly.
No, but that's the thing. And that's the worry. You can't go over the top with testing for things because you get all sorts of, you know, answers you don't want. But the thing is, cancer is expensive to treat and it's very costly in terms of life lost. So, you know, getting it early is the key.
Our final story has to do with speaking parentese to your kids.
Yes. So you have young children and Lara has one on the way. How might you address a little person in your family? Perhaps somebody who's less than 2 years old.
Less than 2 years old. Well, I would speak to them like an adult.
In a radio voice.
In a radio voice.
Good morning.
You're trying to get it to speak like...
Parentese.
Let's imagine.
I thought it said parentheses. I thought the story was about brackets. Oh my God.
Oh, I wish I could do a story about
that's
brackets.
That's terrible.
Can
that's
I
so
can Bombdas? Remember that?
Yes. Yeah.
Let's speak to Shane like he's our child. Would that be fine?
Okay.
Come here, little kitty.
Look
at that smile.
Which of you is more patronizing / annoying? Yeah, I have the best
you're
boy.
You're the best boy.
You are the best boy. So that's what you're talking about.
That's exactly it. Now, which is different to baby talk, which is the goo goo gaga stuff, which is nonsensical, right? So there's been a study done in the US, of course, where they followed 48 families, some of whom were coached into doing this parentese, not parentheses. And
clever, isn't he? Actually,
and look,
I can
clever
boy.
Don't ask me to spell it. So they found that when people were coached to do this what's called child-directed speech, that the child at 18 months had 100 words in their vocabulary versus children who didn't have this coached parenting, where they only had 60 words. So there was a noticeable statistical difference between that those two groups. What's interesting is why. Okay, so they're saying that when you do this parentheses, you're over-enunciating, right? You're doing a sing-song sort of approach. You do pitch modulation and you use very simple English and simple grammar. And they're saying for the child, that's easier to pick up on. And they're saying it's an audible hook for them. So they recognise it. I have a little niece and she's a year old. And so I'm going to try this. Maybe my brother, who's her dad, mightn't like me doing these experiments on the kids. I used to do them more on the dog, but this one's more. So now that I have a niece, I can do these experiments in my family, which is great.
I speak to my cat like that. Do you think my cat
Yeah,
speak
I speak
better?
To the dog like that. So the dog just looks at me and goes, are you going to feed me or bring me for a walk? And that's about it.
Yeah. Didn't learn much out of it.
Yeah.
Okay, as always, a weird end to our news round. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Duggan, thank you very much. All right, on the way, a good hard stare at the sun, the countdown to the launch of Solar Orbiter. Now, this Sunday sees a very extraordinary space mission by the European Space Agency, in which the Solar Orbiter will attempt to do a number of swing around planets and land not far away from the star at the centre of our solar system. Here to tell us all about it is Professor Peter Gallagher with DIAS, and he's also a space science advisory committee member for the European Space Industry. And this is a solar mission, so you must be giddy with excitement.
Well, I mean, this is the mission of a lifetime for me. Yeah. You know, I started my PhD on a mission back in 1997, and this is it. You know, this is the culmination of 20 years of work, and there'll be nothing like it in the rest of my career. So, you know, I'm nervous. We've worked on it for 10 years. We've written software from it. We've like defined all of the science for it. We've been working with teams all around Europe, all around the world for this moment, for this launch, where you put a highly explosive thing underneath our beautiful rock, our beautiful spacecraft, and launch it out into the solar system and hope that nothing goes wrong. And there's many things that go wrong. So nervous and excited, and my first launch as well. I've never seen a spacecraft be launched before. No.
Oh, it's something else.
You've seen one.
I have. I was at the, not of a Saturn V now, which is the bigger rockets that the European Space Agency were using, but a smaller rocket. And it is something else to be in that environment. And
it was an Ariane. It was an Ariane. Yes, it would have been an Ariane spacecraft.
And it is very, very interesting. But how involved have Irish scientists been in this particular mission?
Yeah, well, there's 10 scientific instruments going up. A number of them are cameras, and one of the cameras we're working on, and it takes X-ray pictures of the sun, and it's called Styx, and we're working on that one, and we have been writing software for it. So when a flare happens on the sun, an explosion happens on the sun, our piece of software on the spacecraft goes, there was a flare, it happened at that position on the sun, and it happened at this time, and it sends out a flag to all the other instruments saying, hey, exciting stuff on the left, go and have a look at it.
Right.
And so that's one of our pieces. But also the equipment itself, when the data comes back down, it's weird, it's wonderful, it's awful, it's a pain in the neck, but we've been working on trying to understand how to process that data and turn it into the pretty pictures that we then release to everybody to enjoy afterwards, and for also for scientists to use to study about these solar flares and solar eruptions and try to understand what the energies are involved and so on.
There is a mission at the moment, Parker, which is around the sun, and it's the stats on that thing, not that this is a competition in any way, but like the speeds at which these machines go, this is going to set a record of 190 kilometres a second, which is from here to Limerick in a second. And that is a long drive. And so it's amazing to think about just the statistics with this. With Solar Orbiter, it's not going as close as Parker. It's not going to be going as fast. It's going to be doing something different. What is the point of Solar Orbiter?
Yeah, really interesting. In fact, they work very well together. What Parker will do, and it's a NASA mission, it'll fly, and it's in a tiny orbit, really, really close to the sun. You know, the temperatures are hundreds of degrees Celsius. Yeah. I actually don't... It's almost incomprehensible how the engineering works and how it handles the heat.
1,300 degrees centigrade.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Solar Orbiter is 500 degrees Celsius. And actually, the heat shield was built in Clonmel by a company called Enbio.
Oh, yeah.
So the Solar Orbiter spacecraft is protected by Irish sunblock. I love that. You know, we get sunburned more than anybody else in the whole world. And we're given the responsibility. So we know about sunburn. We know a bit about technology. Anyway, what Solar Orbiter will be doing is it'll be taking pictures. It has five cameras, whereas Solar Probe only has one camera on it. And Solar Probe is really going around kind of tasting the solar wind as it goes around, working out the temperatures and densities of the solar wind, working out the magnetic field. And as stuff moves past it in space, it then gets to Solar Orbiter, which is a little further out. And then Solar Orbiter says, well, has it changed since then? So it's looking at the flow. And, you know, you could imagine being down at the Liffey here. And, you know, if you're on O'Connell Bridge and you look at the water there, but then if you're out in the bay, what's the difference between being out in the bay and being at O'Connell Bridge in terms of how fast the water is flowing? What's the composition of the water? And what's going on? And is it turbulent or is it streamlined kind of laminar flow? And that's what the two spacecraft working together will do, give us a very comprehensive view of the sun and how it affects the solar system.
Yeah, the difference in charged particles further out from that really close, I think orbiter is 6.3 million kilometres, which doesn't sound very far, but considering the sun is 150 million, it's really, really close. The difference between that and Solar Orbiter, are you expecting to see a big difference in the composition of the material that is flying out from the sun?
There could be. I mean, the sun is mainly hydrogen, a little bit of helium in there, some carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, a little bit of iron as well. But there's something going on low down in the sun. There's, you know, at the surface of the sun, it's 6,000 degrees Celsius, roughly. But once you move away from it, instead of getting cooler, as you might expect from your fireplace, you know, you walk away from a fireplace, it gets cooler. On this the temperature actually rises, which is weird. There's something weird going on in the solar atmosphere. And the Parker Solar Probe is flying through the atmosphere where the acceleration and where the heating happens. Hmm. But then by the time you get out into the solar system, things are just, they've been accelerated. So there should be a difference between what we're seeing. Maybe there's waves low down, maybe there's waves... there's no waves further on out, which says acceleration happens near to the sun and heating happens near to the sun. Once you're out there, it's just all flowing past you. But there's also some other interesting things that when the Aurora Borealis, when the Northern Lights hits us, and you've seen the Northern Lights at one point, and I barely saw them one time, so still jealous about that one. But as these solar storms and solar wind move through the solar system, they carry a magnetic field with them. And the magnetic field is everything about whether or not the aurora happens. If it's pointing south, you get a big aurora. If it's pointing north, you don't get a big aurora. And what we'll see with these two spacecraft is it might be that the magnetic field rotates as it moves through space. So the Parker might see it pointing north, and then by the time it gets to the next one, it may have rotated. So it's kind of like...
You have a great A-B sample between the orbiter and Parker to see what happens really close to the sun and then just that little bit further out.
Yeah, but also as they're making measurements, as they're making it in situ, it's called, you know, as things goes past it, we've got cameras, so we'll be watching them, and then we'll be able to reconcile that there's an enormous thing enveloping the spacecraft. And they're making measures of it. We'll be able to put together the images with the actual measurements. So it's like, you know, if I look out at the clouds there out through the window here, you know, I could look at them with my eyes, but I don't actually know what the temperature and the density is in there. And I don't know really what it's like in there. So I'll fly an airplane through that, make the measurements, and I'll take my pictures here, put the two of them together, and you get the comprehensive view of what's going on.
A machine, as you say, it's got lots of different instruments, and they all have different requirements from a mechanical point of view. Some need to be really cold, some need to be able to function at really high heats. Dust is a big issue. How much work goes into the creation of this one satellite, or I suppose a probe?
It's amazing. The first proposal, I think, was 1990 that went forward for this spacecraft. Wow. So it was first conceived of back then. And the budget has fluctuated all along that. There's been many de-scopes on it. There's been many problems. There was problems with the connectors on the spacecraft at one point. Somebody got the wrong plugs when the instruments were brought in, which set the whole thing back 6 months. And when you set something that's like... It started off at 450 million euros and it ended up being an awful lot more expensive.
$1.5 billion, I
think. Well, the spacecraft itself that Europe spent was about 750 million. Then NASA spent about 300 million doing the launch.
Right.
So you're over €1 billion once you get to that kind of numbers. So it's an... Remember, in Europe, you've got the French delivering something, you've got the Germans delivering something, you've got the British delivering something, you've got the Irish delivering something, and then you've got the spacecraft contractor, which is Airbus, and they've built it.
Yeah.
And it has to make sure that when you bring these 10 pieces of equipment together from all around Europe, that they all slot into the right boxes with the right plugs at the back of them, with the right power supplies, with the right internet.
Yeah.
And just, you know, think about your laptop. I can't get the Wi-Fi connected on my laptop half the time.
If you think, what is it, about the size of a fridge, a little bit bigger than
a car?
Oh,
no, this is a big one. This is a big one. This is about 4 metres tall.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
This is a big piece of kit.
Oh, yeah, because I saw photographs of the fairing, which is where it's housed, and it is...
That's 4 metres in diameter.
Huge.
Yeah. It's
okay.
An enormous piece of spacecraft.
That said... You know, you're talking about something the size of, you know, a large shed or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, garden shed.
And that costing €1 billion, it gives you an idea of the complexity, the precision, the time frames, the mapping, which is what makes the European Space Agency such a great organization and I suppose a demonstration of the potential of human beings.
Yeah, I mean, it is expensive, but by comparison with the total European budget that we spend, we only spend a small amount on space exploration. I think it's less than 1% is what we spend. So by comparison with the Americans or the Chinese or the Indians, we're actually still spending way below us, and certainly the Chinese and the Indians are going to overtake us in the next number of years. But what's important about this is that there's European innovation around the system. So the camera that we built, nobody has built an X-ray camera like the one that we're involved in. It's a one of a kind. The detectors were designed, you know, in Switzerland. The grids were designed actually in the United States, and they were all put together. So it's all one-off pieces of kit. But who knows, in the future, will those X-ray detectors be useful for your teeth or cancer diagnostics,
yeah,
or even the software that we write to make the images is then useful for CAT scans. And that's actually true. You know, it is kind of a weird way of making images and they can be used in medical applications. So there's spin-off there, but it also helps European companies remain innovative, keeps them competitive, keeps them innovative, and keeps on pushing back against, you know, global challenges and keeps them at the state of the art. And it's these grand scientific problems that push them that little bit farther.
Whose job has the most jeopardy in this mission? Who's the one person you wouldn't want to be? There must be a small person or a small group of people upon whom everything rides. And you're talking 30 years since conception, €1 billion. If it's gone, it's gone. Everything's gone. All of that work is completely in vain. And of course, you don't want to think about it because we've become used to this idea that these launches just work, but they don't work all the time. So whose job is the one with the most pressure come Sunday?
I think I wouldn't like to be the people responsible for the rocket. You know, that's a candle that you light, and once you light that candle, you ain't blowing it out and you're not turning off the engine. Yeah. And that thing is just going to take off. But just imagine if one of the sensors was saying, yeah, you're going left, and actually it's not, it's going right. Or, you know, and if that's happening, then you're on your way up and suddenly you're going a little bit to the left instead of to the right. And that means you're heading in the wrong direction. That kind of thing. I think people responsible, the spacecraft, or the rocket engineers, I'd be really nervous about them.
And actually, it's why they say, it, you know, it's not rocket science.
It's not rocket science. Yeah, I love using that. I mean, what else would a rocket scientist use? But well, actually, I'm not a rocket scientist, I'm a space scientist. But I think I'd be very nervous. And they brought it out 2 weeks ago, put it onto the launch pad, did a test, and there was a leak in some of the systems that are delivering fuel and exhaust and so on. So they had to bring it back in. And then, so, you know, I'd be very nervous there. And, you know, for all of us, it'll be huge disappointment. But the technology innovation doesn't disappear. That stays on. We still know how to do it now. We just didn't get the data at the end, you know. So it'll be traumatizing, I think, for many of us.
Just finally, what are the aims of this mission in terms of what sort of data? You talked about taking photographs, but there are lots of other instruments there. What is the overall goal? What are you hoping to understand? Because This mission will show us a side of the sun that we don't normally see, right? We get to see the poles, which from Earth, we only ever get to see the
equator.
The equator, yeah.
Yeah, so this spacecraft is going to fly past Venus. And as it flies past Venus, it's going to use the gravity of Venus to kind of crank it out of the plane of the planets. All the planets are in a plane as they orbit. They all orbit in the same kind of disk or the same kind of plane. But this, every time it passes Venus, it's going to crank it a little bit up and it's going to go higher and higher and higher above the planets. And that's going to give it a perspective onto the sun's poles. And we've never seen what's going on the poles of the sun. And, you know, what it reminds me of is when we first went, and I think it was Saturn we looked at, and there was this hexagonal pattern up at the North Pole, really weird with these vortices in it. Nobody expected it. But will we see something like that? And that tells us about a rotating star that has a fluid in it, which is the fluid. And it just tells us something about the way stars work, the way our sun works and the way stars work in a way that we wouldn't know without doing really ambitious missions like this.
Do mathematical models not give us that data?
But a mathematical theory is just a theory until it's proved right or wrong. And, you know, I love this idea that I could prove Einstein right or wrong. As a scientist, that's your goal. You want to prove somebody particularly wrong. Wouldn't it be wonderful to say, here's the leading person in the field and we're going to test their theory and find that it's wrong? And that causes all the, you know, the theoretical physicists and modelers to go off there and start doing their calculations again. And that's the way science works, is constantly checking, constantly discovering. And actually, if we discover the unknown that they haven't thought of before, that's also really interesting. You publish your paper and everybody's scratching their heads going, I didn't expect that. Mm. And nature generally throws up things that the human mind hasn't thought of before.
Well, the best of luck on Sunday, Professor Peter Gallagher. I know there's a lot of eggs in this basket, so let's hope everything goes smoothly. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
I don't know if I've mentioned on the programme that I went with Peter into the path of the solar eclipse. Maybe I've mentioned it. I'm not sure if I have. It seems like I may have. I mention it as much as I possibly can. Right. Time to look back at some of your emails, texts and tweets from last week. And we do this every week. We get to the stuff that you comment on air live and we dissect it here at the end of the podcast. we were talking about the 3,000-year-old mummy's voice that was reconstituted, which we all called bullshit on, really. It was bollocks. Sorry to use the phrase, but it was an interesting idea, at least. And the idea was that they took a 3D scan of this ancient mummy's trachea and then blew some air through it, and it sounded ridiculous. This is the sound. Like, that is, I mean, how does that help anyone, and how is that useful from a scientific, cultural, or, I don't know, how is that in any way useful? It's funny, though. Someone says, that reminds me of the sound I made this morning after my Chinese curry and tiger beer. Oh, come on. Do you know what? I have an Achilles heel in humor, and it is toilet humor. I can't, the F word for me is not F-U-C-K. It's the other one. I can't abide hearing it. I don't know what it is. Maybe something happened to me as a child. Just joking about anything that happens below the navel, it just makes me sexual innuendo is not so problem. I don't have a problem with that. It's the other stuff. I just, you know, bodily functions. I don't know. And we did a piece once, I think, on transferring putra. Yeah, that was... I struggled all the way through that one. Right. We were talking about bioluminescence. Wasn't that an amazing piece? We spoke to Edie Witter about bioluminescence and how the majority of vertebrates glow and how they glow and what they glow. It's fascinating. David Dawes says, hi, Jonathan. If possible, could you give me the name and details of the American woman? Just have Edie Witter. She was on the show. She was talking about illumination and sea creatures. And she did loads of experiments, actually, for the last number of decades with submersibles. And she created these robots that glow like octopuses. Very cool. Keep up the great work on uncovering new information and facts about the world we live in. And then I get a thumbs up emoji and an emoji with a smile and shades. Fantastic. Thanks, David. On whale song, someone says, dear Jonathan, my son heard your podcast about the changing pitch of the sand whales. And as he plays brass instruments, he told me the bigger the instrument, the lower the pitch. He said the whale pitch might be lower because they're getting bigger. Problem solved. Well, that's from Paul Dundon. Paul, kudos to your son. He's got a very good and tried and tested theory. When we look at changes, we have to try and figure out some sort of mechanism. Brilliant approach and brilliant hypothesis. I think they looked at that and there wasn't a huge amount of evidence for that. It is a good solid theory. It hasn't been proven, but definitely one for the mix, Paul's son. So fair dues. And Jonathan being wrong about Nobel Prize quotas. Oh, so this is a conversation I had. We had an argument, myself and producer Aidan McKelvey, about whether or not there should be quotas for gender. And my argument has consistently been not particularly popular either with men or women. But I've yet to be convinced to the other side, and I'm very open to that. But my argument would be societal change takes hundreds of thousands of years. Change in regulation or legislation or just the rules, for example, with Nobel Prizes, you do it in a single year. Yes, the first few people would wonder, would I ever got that? But if you make it a male and female gender quota, then the male will probably also wonder, did I get it just because I'm a man? And that you remove that doubt. And so if you have mandatory male and female quotas, then surely everybody's happy. Or everybody's unhappy to the same amount, which is the same thing, in my opinion. That's a win. So that's my thoughts on board membership and so on. You should have to have half and half men and women. The problem, of course, then gets a little bit more complicated when you talk about ethnic diversity, and then you're into a whole nother. But if we just try to not include that in this idea, that's obviously problematic. You know, when we get to ethnic diversity, that is a huge problem in how you work with quotas. But in terms of male, female, I think that's not a bad idea. And Alan tweeted saying, just isn't your argument on podcast for you women and Nobel Prizes. Yes, I'm way behind our three daughters, but also thought women quotas were BS. But I struggle with that opinion. Your argument has opened my eyes. Yes, Alan. Keep doing what you're doing, dude. All right. The thing is, I said this to Alan on Twitter. I said, look, in fairness, it's completely defensible. It's a completely defensible position to say, no, it's insulting to the first rake of women who take up these roles. But I think equal mandatory quotas for everybody, and everybody's unhappy, which is great. We always get these weird texts from people. This is from Your Dingle Darling, is how they've signed off. And this is, Laura, since following you 2 years ago, I've made my man redundant and taken complete control of all the DIY around the house. I'm now off to rod the sewer. Wish me luck. I have to say, I don't know if that's a euphemism or something. I have no idea what's going on there. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Ed McKelvey, who's producing, researching with Simon Keane on sound, Jojo Cardozo. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed over the next week. In the meantime, stay curious.